Today is Monday, May 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. The death toll from a recent bomb attack in Kabul, Afghanistan, climbs to more than 60.
The attack environment was very tragic, and it's still very tragic. Yesterday, I went to one of the nearest hospitals in our residence, where I found a young man sitting next to her sister's dead body.
Plus, tensions are high in Jerusalem after clashes near Islam's third most holy site. And we take a look at the way some creatures celebrate motherhood. We'll have these stories and more next. The death toll from a bomb attack outside a school Saturday evening in the Afghan capital has risen to at least 68, with doctors struggling to care for 165 injured victims and families searching desperately for missing children. Reporter Zermal Hashemi spoke to me from Kabul.
The attack environment was very tragic, and it's still very tragic. Yesterday, I went to one of the nearest hospital in our residence, where I found a young man sitting next to her sister's dead body. I approached him and asked why was she crying and where were the rest of her family members. He replied, "My mother was gone to another hospital where my other sister is seriously wounded." I then asked, "Where is your father?" He grievously said, "He is at another hospital where one of my sister was also injured and under treatment." When I asked him about how he felt, he said, "It was one of the most traumatic moments of my life."
As I understand it, the Afghan government has accused the Taliban of carrying out this attack. The Taliban have denied any responsibility, but there are also some people who are saying that perhaps the Islamic State militant group is responsible for the attack. Can you explain why they are making that presumption?
Although the IS still didn't claim the responsibility, as well as the Taliban, and no other group or person claimed the responsibility of the attack. But because the attack was on a Hazara or Shia minorities, the IS in recent years several times this group attacked this minority.
What are people in Afghanistan saying about not only this latest attack that affected so many young individuals, but the increase in conflict throughout the state after that May 1st start of drawdown of both U.S. and international troops?
Generally, I'm just blaming all conflict sites, including government, U.S., and Taliban group. They say government is corrupted, and it is one of the main causes affecting their life. They blame U.S. because they believe it is in such uncertain time, it is not a comprehensive withdrawal of forces, foreign forces from Afghanistan. Although the U.S. forces already have begun withdrawal from Afghanistan and from its bases in all areas of Afghanistan. They also blame the Taliban group because they say that they skyrocketing the attack in remote areas of the Afghanistan. They say ongoing war is one of the main cause of such uncertainties in their country.
So what are they looking for in terms of actions by the Afghan government or, for that matter, any other international partners to increase the security situation in the country in which they live?
They say that the government should secure their life. They say that the government is a responsible side to secure their life. And they say that this is their right to have a secure life at least. If they have no other facilities in their life, but they say the government should finalize the peace process and bring a peace to Afghanistan.
Zermal Hashemi spoke to me from Kabul, Afghanistan. Pope Francis called the attack an inhuman act in remarks to pilgrims in St. Peter's Square in Vatican City Sunday. And United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres also condemned the attack, as well as expressed his deepest sympathies to the victims' families and to the Afghan government and people. In Israel, clashes erupted between Palestinian protesters and Israeli police outside the old city of Jerusalem over the weekend. The violence took place as tens of thousands of Muslim worshippers prayed at the nearby Al-Aqsa Mosque on Islam's holy night of Laylat al-Qadr. Reporter Orly Halpern explains that the confrontation stems from a long, unresolved issue.
Prior to the creation of Israel, prior to 1948, there was land that was owned by a Jewish religious organization. Now, what happened was that after the 1948 war, this land was on the side that Israel was not in control of. And Palestinians built homes there. Actually, the Jordanians built them for Palestinian refugees. But when Israel conquered the West Bank and got control of it again, then some organizations moved to get control of this land and to evict the Palestinians that were living there until today, saying that this land belonged to Jewish organizations. So the problem is that the Palestinians say, well, Israel says this is a land dispute. It's a legal dispute over land. But the Palestinians say this isn't a land dispute because your law that you created in 1948 that gives Jews to take back the right to take back their land, it's only good for Jews. It doesn't work for Arabs. There's the double standard here. All the Palestinians can't get back their land. So the Palestinians see this as a conflict over discrimination and also a way for religious Jewish organizations to put Jews into the east side, into the Palestinian side of the city. So this is where it starts. And you have some 300 people, Palestinian people, who are about to be evicted. And there is an appeal that was supposed to be taking place tomorrow, a discussion in the high court about this.
Yeah, Orly, I want to ask you about that because this has been a long ongoing legal dispute between the parties involved. So what can you tell us about the postponement of this legal case in Israel's Supreme Court?
What happened was the Attorney General of the country asked the High Court to please postpone it in light of the security situation. And so the High Court agreed and only said that there would be a new date within 30 days. More than that, we don't know.
So how are people viewing the dispute in light of the recent violence?
These homes have become very symbolic of that struggle. So now it's attracted all kinds of people, left-wing Jewish people that believe in the rights of for Palestinians, as well as members of the Israeli Knesset, and also Palestinians that are not necessarily living there. They just think this is wrong, and they are protesting against it. And as a result, we had this blow-up on Friday evening where hundreds of people gestured to throw stones at Israeli police on the Temple Mount, which is a very holy place for Muslims. And in the end, 200 people, Palestinian people, were injured, and 17 Israeli police.
Orly, I want to step away from the politics inside Israel, but what are analysts saying about what kind of impact this may have moving forward in the country?
So the military analysts, the security analysts are saying that the police went overboard and this can only make things worse. Now, regionally speaking, from the Arab countries that are surrounding the areas, they're, of course, condemning this. But not only, you also see that the EU has asked Israel not to go through with these evictions, the European Union. And you see the U.S. has a more restrained response. It said, you know, that it's very concerned about the violence and it calls on all sides to pull back from the situation. And, you know, then you have some that have a much more extreme statement calling Israel, saying that this was state terror. So, and that was Turkey. Even Israel's new friends, the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, and Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia, which Israel is beginning to make relations with, all these countries condemned Israel. So even Israeli newspapers were condemning Israel, that this was going overboard. So it appears that the situation, Israel has started to think twice about how it's reacting because it did decide not to have the hearing tomorrow so as to calm the winds. However, tomorrow is the day that Israel celebrates Jerusalem being conquered, the other half, the half where that neighborhood is in. And that might not be a problem in general. But what has happened for the recent years is that there have been extremist religious Jews who have been making this thing called a flag march, where they go into the Muslim quarter of the old city of Jerusalem and they march through it with enormous Israeli flags, and they curse Arabs and sometimes start fights with them, and it's become very violent and very ugly. So that's where we stand now. Things are very tense.
Orly Halpern was speaking to me from Jerusalem. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Myanmar poet Khet Ti, whose works declare resistance to the ruling junta, died in detention overnight, and his body was returned with the organs removed, according to his family. A spokesman for the junta did not answer calls to request comment on the death of Khet Ti, who had penned the line, "They shoot in the head, but they don't know the revolution is in the heart." His Facebook page said he was 45. Over the weekend, Myanmar's military rulers branded a rival national unity government a terrorist group and blamed it for bombings, arson, and killings. Myanmar's army has struggled to impose orders since seizing power on February 1st and detaining elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Bombings are reported daily, and local militias have been formed to confront the army. This as anti-junta protests continue across the Southeast Asian country, and strikes by opponents of the coup have paralyzed the economy. Australia said it will offer nationals living there a safe haven. And Phil Mercer has that part of the story.
Canberra has been under pressure to offer a haven to more than 3,300 Myanmar citizens in Australia. More than half of them are students, and their visas will be extended. Many have said they fear persecution or arrest if they return home to a country scarred by weeks of civil unrest after the military in Myanmar ousted the elected government of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. However, it's not clear how long Australia will extend visas for, or how it will determine whether and when it's safe for Myanmar nationals to return home. Tozor Lat, the operations director for the Democratic Voice of Burma, a non-profit media organization, said he welcomes the decision to allow them to stay.
I think it is a right move for Australian government to extend visa. It's like in U.S. and, you know, it's happened many places, especially overseas student visa is a grant extension. I strongly welcome this move, and they should do more to bring more people who needed asylum or more of their safe places, especially in Australia. I think this is in the right direction.
In Canberra, Immigration Minister Alex Hawke said in a statement that Australia continued to strongly urge the Myanmar security forces to exercise restraint and refrain from violence against civilians, release those detained arbitrarily, and engage in dialogue. Meanwhile, Australia's Home Affairs Department has launched an investigation into relatives of Myanmar's military living in Australia. There are concerns they are either harbouring assets taken from Myanmar or receiving financial support from the military in Myanmar following February's uprising. News reports have suggested that more than 20 family members of senior officials of Myanmar's new military government were living in Australia. Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy Party won a landslide victory in an election in November with more than 80% of the vote. She was placed under house arrest in February following the military takeover. The Southeast Asian nation, also known as Burma, became independent from Britain in 1948. It was controlled by a harsh military government from 1962 to 2011. Australia has suspended military assistance to Myanmar and redirected aid to non-government organizations. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Ethiopia's Tigray region has been ravaged by 6 months of conflict between the Tigray People's Liberation Front rebels and a military alliance of the Ethiopian and Eritrean armies, as well as their associated militias. Now there are fears of widespread starvation as continued violence threatens to disrupt the planting season. For analysis, VOA's Jason Patinkin reached out to Professor Alex DeWall, who's the executive director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University in Massachusetts. DeWall is an expert in humanitarian crises and famine in the Horn of Africa.
I've worked on issues of famine, war, atrocity, genocide, etc. for 37 years. And never in my career have I witnessed or documented a situation of such widespread and systematic and utterly brutal destruction of what is essential to sustain life. This is not only a man-made famine, it is a starvation crime on the hugest scale.
Now, a famine has not been declared in Tigray. We spoke to MSF yesterday, and they said that while one indicator, malnutrition, is above the emergency threshold, and emergency is one step below famine, other indicators, such as mortality, were not at the famine level for the people they have access to.
A famine is unavoidable under the current situation. There are, according to the United Nations, between 4.5 and 5.2 million people in immediate need of humanitarian assistance. And of those, about 1 million are receiving that. The majority of those in need, and those in gravest need, are beyond the reach of international assistance. The people whom Médecins Sans Frontières are seeing in their clinics are those for whom they have some access. They are not seeing the worst situation that prevails elsewhere. And as the weeks go by, that situation will only deteriorate. What is driving this crisis is not drought. It's not locusts. What it is a combination of a war and a determination, starvation crimes by the Ethiopian federal forces, the Eritrean army, and the militia from neighboring Amhara to starve the people of Tigray. So what I very much fear, and the evidence is now overwhelming, is that we are on a very steep downward trajectory towards a disaster, the scale of which we have not seen in decades.
And what's the evidence that you have for this deliberate campaign that you allege?
Despite the information blackout, enough information has leaked out about the deliberate destruction of foodstuffs, the vandalization, destruction of clinics, the destruction of employment opportunities, and the level of rape, of sexual violence, is also extremely high. And that is a starvation crime. Many women and girls, because of fear of rape, are unable to do those essential activities, looking for food, going to market, or even going to look for assistance that would keep themselves and their families alive.
Now, I want to bring in the government's view. When your organization first made this allegation last month of a deliberate starvation campaign, they said in a statement to BBC that your allegations are entirely detached from the facts on the ground. They also said it wasn't them, but it was the rebels, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, who are responsible because they attacked Ethiopian army posts last year right before the harvest season. And they also accused the TPLF of deliberately destroying infrastructure while retreating. Essentially, they're saying, you're wrong, and this is the TPLF's fault. What's your response?
2 points. First of all, regardless who might have started the war, it is a war crime to go around systematically, relentlessly destroying hospitals, destroying food, raping women and children. They had nothing to do with this war and how it started. Secondly, every senior aid official with whom I have been in contact tells me that what we describe in our report is not only true, but the reality is worse.
Last of all, what do you think needs to happen to either prevent a famine from occurring or to mitigate its effects if, as you say, it is inevitable?
The first thing is to allow communication, to let the world see. If there is nothing to hide, then why is the Ethiopian government hiding it? Why has it shut off communications, shut down the internet, prevented aid groups from speaking candidly? Let us go in and see what is happening. Let us also then have a ceasefire. It is a war. The government refuses to concede that it is a war. And then let us move to reconstructing the destroyed infrastructure, compensating and providing reparations to the hundreds of thousands, millions of victims of this needless and brutal war.
That was the executive director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University, Alex DeWall, speaking to my colleague, Jason Patinkin. All sides in the Tigray conflict are accused of atrocities. The Ethiopian government has at times both denied and admitted that its troops have committed abuses in Tigray. The Eritrean government has denied all allegations against its forces, but says anyone responsible for sexual violence should be punished. The TPLF has described the attack before the planting season as a preemptive strike and has also denied accusations of atrocities.
This is Science in a Minute.
Hypertension or high blood pressure is considered a top risk factor for heart disease and stroke. Hypertension is usually treated with changes in lifestyle and prescription medications. Despite such efforts, some still have problems controlling their blood pressure. New research presented before the American College of Cardiology suggests patients who take other medications, both prescribed and over-the-counter, may have trouble controlling hypertension. Among the drugs that researchers found to interfere with hypertension treatment are non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen, oral steroids, antipsychotic, contraceptive, and decongestant medications. The researchers say their results stress the need for patients to talk often with their doctors to review all the medications they take. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Chad's military claimed victory Sunday in its weeks-long battle with the northern rebels that led to the death of President Idriss Deby on the battlefield. However, the rebel group, the Front for Change and Concord in Chad, said it was not aware of an end to fighting. The transitional military authorities have previously said that they have defeated the rebels, only for clashes to continue. India's defense ministry says it will recruit former army medics to support its overwhelmed healthcare system as COVID-19 cases and deaths continue to surge amid angry calls for a nationwide lockdown. Reuters' David Doyle has more.
The country is grappling with record COVID-19 infections and fatalities. Deaths rose by more than 4,000 for a second consecutive day on Sunday, prompting angry calls for a complete nationwide lockdown. The Defence Ministry said some 400 medical officers are expected to serve on a contract for a maximum of 11 months, adding that other defence doctors had also been roped in for online consultations. On Sunday, India reported 4,092 deaths over the previous 24 hours. That's after its highest ever single-day death toll, 4,187, the day before. With an acute shortage of oxygen and beds in many hospitals, and with morgues and crematoriums overflowing, experts say the actual number of fatalities and cases could be much higher than reported. Pressure is mounting on Prime Minister Narendra Modi to announce a nationwide lockdown. He's been criticized for allowing huge gatherings at a religious festival and for holding large election rallies over the past 2 months, even as COVID-19 cases were surging. Many Indian states have imposed their own strict lockdowns. On Sunday, New Delhi's chief minister said a lockdown there would be extended by a week, and subway train services will also be suspended. For some residents in the capital, that's a cause for concern. Hospital worker Rahul says he's heading for his evening shift, but doesn't know how he will get home and does not have enough money to travel in taxis. The Indian Medical Association has called for a complete, well-planned, pre-announced lockdown instead of sporadic night curfews and restrictions.
Reuters reporter David Doyle. In the United States, the operator of a pipeline that transports fuel across the East Coast says that it's the victim of a ransomware attack. The AP's Ben Thomas.
Colonial Pipeline did not say what was demanded or by whom, but ransomware attacks typically involve criminal hackers who seize data and demand a large payment to release it. The companies temporarily halted all pipeline operations. Colonial Pipeline transports gasoline, diesel, jet fuel, and home heating oil from refineries primarily located on the Gulf Coast through pipelines running from Texas to New Jersey, roughly 45% of all fuel consumed on the East Coast. The White House says President Biden has been briefed on the situation, and the federal government is working with state and local authorities to mitigate any potential supply issues. Ben Thomas, Washington.
And finally, Sunday, May 9th was Mother's Day in the United States. It's a special day set aside for honoring mothers and celebrating all those qualities and actions that make mother, mom. But animals and even plants have also evolved their own dizzyingly diverse maternal styles over the millennia, all of which serve to make sure that the next generation thrives. VOA's Adam Phillips has more.
For many Americans, Mother's Day is a time to show our all-too-human mothers that we appreciate them. But for Columbia University ecologist Shahid Naeem, Mother's Day is a time to celebrate mothering in all species of life.
Because we recognize mothering and fathering as critical to the survival of our species, and how that is common not just among all of the different races of humanity, but every single species you see, even if it's just an insect on the ground or plant or mushrooms growing in the forest. It's a sign that life on Earth is working.
Like other primates, we human beings spend long periods of time gestating, then caring for our young, usually in groups. Columbia zoology professor Marina Cords, who has spent years observing groups of blue monkeys in the forests of Kenya, is often reminded of them when she sees groups of human mothers and their infants in New York City's Central Park.
Because the non-human primates, you often find that the mothers and infants hang around together. When I see that in the park, it's exactly what I think of. Oh, there's one of those gaggles of mothers and kids sharing the job of watching the kids. Many pairs of eyes watching over those vulnerable youngsters at once might prevent them from being picked on by a predator or harassed by somebody in the group who's a little bit malevolent.
Unlike primate mothers, many other animal mothers do not stay around to raise their young. Shahid Naeem says frogs offer one example.
Frogs lay their eggs and then they go away. But in the case of the gastric brooding frog, the tadpoles actually grow up in the stomach of the mother and then eventually emerge as little frogs outside of the mouth of the mother. They've seen pictures of this. It's very strange. And there are some tree frogs as well in which the tadpoles stay very close to the mother and will derive both protection and nutrition from the mother. So even among what we think of as primitive vertebrates, you'll still see some range of parental care.
Most animal mothers protect their young in some way.
We've all admired cat picking up their offspring one by one and moving them from a place where they thought is no longer safe. Birds will wander around and pretend like they have a broken wing to try to distract the predator away from the eggs. We all know if you encounter a goose that's raising goslings, it's going to be very aggressive to you when it's trying to scare you away from its offspring.
Human mothers teach their young, often by joining them in observing and interacting with the external world, then discussing it with them. Other animals learn on their own, mostly by observation and mimicry. But Professor Marina Cord says there are other clever ways that mammalian young manage to learn from their mothers.
There are some cases reported, for example, of large cats bringing dead antelope to their young, and they can sort of pounce on it and kill it even though it's actually dead. So she's providing an opportunity to them in a way. You see young ones sniffing the mouths of their mothers, for example, and you wonder if they're learning what the smell of that food is that mom is consuming, and then they might recognize that when they meet that food at some point in the future.
Plants have also developed ingenious maternal strategies for engendering and nurturing the next generation. And how fortunate, says Shahid Naeem, that many of those strategies nurture us, too.
Most of our food that we are eating, whether it's rice or wheat or fruits, tomatoes, cucumbers, apples, these are actually the hard work of the mother, which has very often provided lots of nutrients, moisture, and water for them. And in many cases, the mother will actually put poisons or toxins into the outer coverings of the fruit to prevent it from being eaten. When the tomato is ready to be eaten, then it becomes edible and we seek them. In that case, the mother is actually trying to encourage us or an animal to eat the fruit so that it will then digest away all of that material, go away from the mother plant, and then deposit the seeds in a nice little pack of manure.
However you look at it, almost all life owes not only its creation, but also its survival to mom. And that's all the more reason we should take the time out to contemplate and celebrate motherhood all year long. I'm Adam Phillips reporting from New York.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day you can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.